This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing, intelligent, and oh-so-curious friends. You are looking marvelous. Hi, my name is Jet Li, and this is the Solve It for Kids podcast, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, physicists, and astronauts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, cooperation, creativity, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson!
Hello, Jet!
Hey, Jennifer, I am so excited about being back here on the Solve It for Kids podcast. I always have such a great time.
Well, today's show is going to be so cool. It's kind of mysterious.
Well, I can't wait till we figure out what problem we're going to solve today.
Well, spin the wheel. Let's go.
Here we go.
What is antimatter, and why does it matter to us?
What is antimatter, and why does it matter to us? Isn't antimatter that stuff that if it mixes with matter on Star Trek, like the world ends?
Yes, that actually is. That's what I said. It's very mysterious. This is another one of those shows about stuff you can't see, feel, or touch, but is so awesome to learn about.
Ooh, I can't wait. Who are we going to talk to about it?
Well, we have Dr. Chloe Malbruno, who is a physicist who works at the antimatter factory at CERN. In Geneva, Switzerland. How cool is that?
That is really, really cool. I can't wait. Hey, welcome to Solve It for Kids, Dr. Chloe.
Thanks.
Welcome. So let's start out with trying to tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Malbruno. Where do you work? What is CERN? And then we can get into what is antimatter.
Okay, so I'm a physicist working at a laboratory called CERN, which is the laboratory which hosts the largest collider in the world. So a collider is a machine which takes particles, tiny, tiny pieces of matter, accelerate them to very large energies, and then smash them against each other to find out what comes out of these collisions. And I think it's something that children and maybe humankind in general seems to like to do.
Smash things, there you go.
Yeah. But the main point here is that we are not smashing things against each other to destroy them, but to learn new things. But actually, my work is not related at all to this 27-kilometer-long collider, which is at CERN, but to another unique machine, which we call the antiproton decelerator. And this machine doesn't accelerate. It slows down pieces of antimatter this time so that we can trap them to understand their properties. So you can ask me what is antimatter.
Yeah, right. That's the next question. What is antimatter?
Antimatter is just like matter. We called it antimatter because when matter and antimatter meet, they disappear in a burst of energy. But in essence, antimatter is just like matter. It's just like when you take, for example, the number 1 and you put it together with -1, you get 0. So you could say 1 is matter, -1 is antimatter, and when you put them together, you get 0 form of matter, but you get energy, which then will create other particles. But really, matter and antimatter are very much the same, and that's what actually one of the big problem and the big questions we are trying to solve.
I'm already confused. You're just 3 minutes in, and I'm like, my head is spinning here. Growing up watching Star Trek and things like that, it was always the idea was, oh, if antimatter and matter meet, boom, the universe is destroyed. You're saying this happens all the time, but I'm still around. I think I'm still around.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point. By trying to understand antimatter, we are really trying to understand our universe. Again, that sounds like a big problem. Universe is something very big. In fact, I'm trying to pinpoint one particular problem in our universe, which is why we don't see antimatter, right?
Right.
You were totally right. If we had a lot of antimatter, then we would not be here. So in fact, I'm trying to understand a bit more about our universe by understanding what is our missing in our universe and why it's missing. So as I said, matter and antimatter are very much alike, and so alike that our equations, so the what we use to mathematically understand our world, tells us that we should actually be surrounded by antimatter, that there should be antimatter like there is matter. But we know that if this was the case, then we would not exist. Mm. So I think that's an enticing problem to want to look at it. Why we don't have antimatter in the world, and so why do we exist actually?
Yeah, that's a great problem. Now, to give our listeners just kind of an idea, when you're talking about antimatter, like, how small are you talking? Like,
well, we are making, we're producing particles of antimatter. So the tiniest thing you can imagine. We're using antiprotons. So this is the antimatter of the proton. The proton, that's the thing which is inside the nucleus of our right. atoms. So it's something which is very, very small. We cannot produce a lot of them. We're talking, for example, about a few million every 100 seconds. That can sound a lot, but in fact, there is many, many, many more than a few hundred which fills our body. So in fact, by producing this antimatter, we would need billion years to create a gram of antimatter. So
a billion years to create a gram of it. Wow. And then that would probably be a lot. That would be
enormous. If we had 1 gram of antimatter and that we could mix this with matter, that would be a huge amount of energy, right? Put things in space with that, but we are not able to do that.
Oh, wow. So how much do you capture at a time when you are decelerate?
So we capture about a million at a time. We can accumulate those.
Which is how much of a gram, though, but like a very, very not even.
Oh, yeah. This is, I mean, you would need 10 to the... over 10 to the 20 in order to have something close to a gram.
Oh, wow.
So we are many, many, many orders of magnitude away from that.
So I'm still trying to catch up here. I'm made out of like a bazillion little pieces of matter. Is that what you're saying?
Of course. You're made by a lot of atoms, which are made of a proton and a neutron, like something which are very small but quite heavy, and an electron orbiting this what we call this nucleus. And you're made you're made of a lot of those. Mm.
Do you have antimatter in you too?
No, you're not built of antimatter, but for example, you actually produce antimatter. I mean, you are irradiating, like a child would be irradiating something like 100 positrons, which is the antimatter of the electron, about 100 per hour. And that's due to the fact that you're eating and you're breathing and you're drinking, stuff which are made of unstable things. Oh. So things which will decay by emitting antimatter. And so you every day encounter some antimatter by, for example, one example that I often give is that one of these nuclei which are unstable is, for example, potassium. Potassium 40 is unstable. It will emit a positron by decaying. And a banana contains a lot of potassium and has some unstable potassium. And so therefore, when you eat a banana or when you touch a banana, you'll encounter some antimatter.
Oh, that's cool. I did not know that.
Is that why people say bananas are great to eat for a workout to give yourself extra energy? I mean, I don't know.
No, that has nothing to do with that.
That has to do with like electrolytes.
Lithium, but not with antimatter.
Okay, so also I know that, you know, the work that you do at CERN is, you know, on the very, very tiny microscopic level, but does this have anything to do, does it relate to anything in space? Like, is there antimatter in space that we're aware of or anything?
No, there isn't. And that's a big problem. So we could not find large amount of antimatter anywhere in the universe. And as I said, we think there should be. Or there is something we don't understand in the physics. And so what we are trying to do in this anti-proton decelerator is try to get some antimatter and form atoms of antimatter. I can detail a bit afterwards what that is.
Oh, yeah.
And form these atoms to try to understand more precisely some properties of antimatter. Maybe when we are able to measure things very precisely and we compare them with matter, we see that there is actually something different that can explain why we are made of matter and that there is no antimatter in the universe.
So how do you work with this antimatter once you capture it? Because you can't expose it, right, to the air.
Yeah, that's because right.
We then cannot, it would disappear.
Yeah, we cannot touch antimatter in a sense. So it cannot touch anything because everything we use to all our equipments are made of matter.
Oh, it can't even touch the container it's in?
No, it cannot touch anything. Oh. So it has to remain in vacuum. So for that, we use, and it has to remain in very good vacuum, because when we talk about vacuum, for example, something, a vacuum that would be created by our vacuum cleaner, this is containing a lot of matter we don't realize, but in fact, it's a lot. And an antimatter particle in our vacuum cleaner would not survive a millisecond. So we need very, very good vacuum, and we need things in order to the antimatter not to touch the apparatus. And for that, we use electromagnetic fields, so magnets and electric fields, so that basically the antimatter are floating in space, are floating in vacuum and not touching anything. And then we send light. Basically, the idea is to send light. We can control light very well, very precisely. And we look at how the atom of antimatter we have formed react to light. And like this, we can understand things about antimatter.
Yeah, to see if the light goes straight through or if it bounces off or if it changes.
Yeah, something
angle.
Like that. We use light to understand how the atom is made. So atoms have different energy levels. So for example, we say that it's either in a ground state or it's excited. It's like, we can really compare this to our status when we are very calm, sleeping, maybe we're in a ground state. And when we're all excited, we're in another state. The atom is like this as well. And we can use light to understand, in which state it is. And that tells us about the atom itself.
This is just fascinating. Yeah. And I want to know if we can't see antimatter and we can't find, and it has to be in this vacuum being held by electromagnets and all, whoever discovered it, how did we discover it? Where did, you know, who had that idea that maybe there's this thing out there that we can't see called antimatter?
Yeah, actually, I mean, since it's like matter, we can actually see it. If we could make a lot of antimatter, we could see it. We could build humans made of antimatter.
Oh, wow.
We would not see much difference, actually. That's the interesting thing. It's so much like matter that we would not distinguish a person which would be made of antimatter from somebody made of matter. The only problem is that when we would kiss this person, we would disappear.
And there'd be a big explosion.
Yeah. But we can see it. Actually, the first time we observed it, it was predicted before we saw it, before we discovered it. Somebody came up with an equation and said, look, It looks like there is another state of matter, which have opposite properties. So, for example, if a proton is charged positively, so it has a charge, the antiproton would be charged negatively. So it has opposite properties, but it behaves the same as far as those properties are concerned. And so the first time we saw it, like, we are bombarded by particles coming from outer space, so protons mostly, coming from explosions of stars. And it's like they're behaving like gigantic accelerators, in fact. And they can propulse a lot of matter in the universe. And some of those are hitting our atmosphere. And like we can make antimatter in accelerators, they are made also in the atmosphere, right? And coming to us. So at the time it was discovered, there was no accelerator. So we could not produce antimatter, like we do now in the laboratories. But, people had detectors and they saw that, that actually there is a particle which looks like having the same mass as the electrons, but in a magnet, it would go the other way around, meaning that it's charged the other way. And so that's how the electron, the positron, the antimatter of the electron was discovered. Yeah, that's a while ago, in the 1930s.
Yeah, that was a while ago. So basically we think that if there's an electron, then there is another particle that is opposite in charge to it. So the electron is negative. And then what is it?
The positron.
Positron. Okay. And the same thing for the proton. There's an antiproton.
Exactly.
So I know that you have also, I want to talk, you did a TEDx talk, which I hope our listeners will put the link on our website so you can go look at it. But I love your question is something, if matter falls down, does antimatter fall up? Do we know the answer to that question?
No, and you will see that in the TED animation, there is no answer because we still haven't measured it. But that's another thing we're trying to do. I told you we're trying to shine light in order to understand how antimatter is behaving, how the atom is. But we also, another thing we want to try is to see how antimatter behaves in the Earth's gravitational field. So you know we are stuck on the surface of the Earth thanks to the gravitational force, right? The Earth is pulling us towards its center. And when you have an apple in your hand and you remove your hand, you know that the apple falls. But maybe an anti-apple would not do the same. Maybe it would not fall but go up. That we don't know because we have never measured it with antimatter. So we never measured how antimatter would behave under gravity. And we want to do this at the antimatter factory. And this is still something that we are trying to do.
But can you do that on Earth? Like, how do you do it without having gravity? Or is this like something you might have to do in space where there's less gravity?
No. The aim is to try to have a gravitational field. So Earth is perfect for that, right?
Okay.
Earth would create the gravitational field. So we don't need an anti-Earth. So what we are, what we are trying to do that here is really to see if gravity, normal gravity affect antimatter.
Okay.
Same way as it affects matter. And so we're doing it on Earth and trying to see this with anti-hydrogen. And that's something which I was mentioning before. We need an atom to do that, because we need something which is neutral, electrically neutral. An antiproton, as I mentioned before, is charged positively, negatively, sorry, a positron is charged positively. Yeah. When you put them together, you form the simplest atom made entirely of antimatter, which is antihydrogen. So hydrogen is proton, electron, antihydrogen is antiproton and positron.
Wow. You know, this sounds like a lot of fun. It's hard for me to understand everything, but just asking, I love that the question that you asked in your TED talk, if matter falls down, does antimatter fall up? I used to ask questions like that in grammar school, and I get in trouble. My teachers get angry at me for being silly. But this is, being like a physicist is like so cool because you can ask those really cool questions and then you get to smash things and try to figure them out.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. And you should not have gotten into trouble because you asked such questions. I think right. This is really the root of science, is trying to think out of the box and trying to see things which sometimes we take for granted, but which are not at all, right? And by asking some sometimes weird questions, you find answers you did not expect. So yeah, I mean, this science is exciting, and I find what we are doing extremely exciting.
I do too. I was lucky enough to visit the CERN antimatter factory, and that's where I met Dr. Cloy, and it was phenomenal being there and seeing this. I mean, you're trying to learn about how our universe works. That's just amazing. But we do ask on this show, do you have any failures or maybe some hypotheses that you thought was going to happen and then you learned, oh, hey, this is completely different from what we thought?
Yeah, I mean, a scientist is always confronted to failure. We're trying to understand completely new things, so we are basically bound to fail all the time. But what is important, I think, is what we learn from those failures and how we use those failures to make the success, right? And we are often, I think, taught at school about the successes of science. And it makes sense in a way because we don't have time to discuss how people got to the point they got to. But right. I think this
which might take years and years and years, right?
Yeah, exactly. This gives somehow the wrong impression about science. Science is not only about genius people who have the perfect intuition. It's a lot about many, many laboratory mice, fun mice, but still who try and fail all the time until at some point they succeed and make a big discovery. So we have many failure. One example, for example, is in the field I'm working on is related to this gravity thing. So at some point, people said, "Oh, okay, we have to answer this question about how antimatter behave under gravity." And at that time, the only antiparticle we could make in relatively large amount was antiparticles which were charged, electrically charged. Mm-hmm. And so they tried to use antiprotons and positrons in order to find how those would behave under gravity. But as you may know, gravity is a very, very weak force. We don't yes. realize it because we are not charged. And luckily we are not, because if we were charged out by a tiny magnet, would be enough to pull us out of the Earth's ground, and we'd be basically floating along magnetic and electric fields, right? So we right. are not charged, and that makes us sometimes forget that gravity is very weak, in fact. And so electromagnetic forces were so much stronger than gravity, and they were not controllable enough to be able to make this measurement. So people tried, and they failed. And this gave basically an impetus to spending a lot of efforts to making antihydrogen, which is again the simplest neutral atom made only of antimatter. And that basically was one of the reasons that we went along on in this field of antihydrogen physics, in order to be able to make such a measurement.
That's awesome. So how long can you hold antihydrogen once you make it? Can you hold it indefinitely in the field, or?
Maybe not indefinitely because we have, we don't have perfect vacuum. We have very, very good vacuum. So we can hold it very long. Typically several years would be possible. We are not doing that because we have breaks, and but we could hold it for very long, yes.
Wow. This really is cool, but I'm wondering, You know, because we love to challenge our listeners to do something related to our conversation. You know, dealing with the stuff that you can't see. How can we challenge our listeners today to go out there and play around with antimatter?
Yeah, well, one challenge I can think of is, as you said, try to think out of the box, really, in your daily life. Try to understand things which might seem obvious but are not. This may be, again, an abstract challenge, but to give an example, I'm often surprised at how surprised people are about the existence of antimatter. But in fact, as I told you, everybody encounter antimatter in their daily life. I told you about the banana, but there is also hospitals, general hospitals use positrons, so the antimatter of the electron, daily to do cancer diagnosis, for example. So we use really antimatter in our daily life. But going away from this antimatter, you can also ask yourself how your cell phone works. How can we communicate so quickly over such long distances, right? This is something that seems obvious because we use it every day, but it's all physics. And sometimes physics, which is not trivial, but it's fun physics. And trying to understand this is fun. And I think it's something... trying to do this on an everyday basis really trains a bit your brain to ask yourself the good questions.
Yeah, I like that. So for our listeners, so your challenge is to go out and look at everyday things and think about the physics behind them. How were they created? You know, how do we use them? Maybe consider antimatter and do an internet search and find out what kind of ways as antimatter used in every day. And then we would love it. Talk to your parents first, but if you want to share some of what you found with pictures or send us notes, you can tag us at KidsSolve on Twitter and Instagram or email us through our website, which is solveitforkids.com. But I think this is a great challenge for kids, Dr. Chloe, because it gets them thinking about the world around them. And I know that's something that I had as a passion, or I still have. But as a kid, it started out, and it's still continued forever. And it seems like you have that in your life, too.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what connects us to science. I always loved making experiments when I was young, and... making printed circuits, solving enigmas. It doesn't have to be necessarily connected really to physics you're taught at school. When I was in high school, I found physics boring, I must say. but it's because I didn't get the right insight into it, I think. And as soon as this discovered the world of particles, then I really got into it. But in your everyday life, if you like solving problems, if you like understanding how things work, then for sure you're made for science.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids today. Dr. Chloe, we enjoyed having you.
Thank you.
Jennifer, Dr. Chloe was amazing.
I know. Oh, my gosh. And believe me, I was so excited because I got to actually tour the antimatter factory, which is the coolest thing ever. But think about it. Something that's there, but it's not there, but interacts, but doesn't interact. I mean, it kind of blows your mind, doesn't it?
Jennifer, my mind was blown like the third episode of the show. So I'm just trying to put it back together.
Well, for all of you listeners out there who want to learn more about antimatter, don't forget to visit our website, solveitforkids.com. Go to the episode page, and there's a whole page about Dr. Chloe and about CERN, and she even has this cool video, which is, why does anti-hydrogen float up?
That's wild.
It's wild, so make sure you check it out. And don't forget to do her challenge. And if you do, tag us on our Twitter and Instagram at KidsSolve, because we would love to see all of the creations that you come up with.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. And we can't wait to see you on the next episode of
Solve It for Kids.